This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Robin Hood in reverse. The Presidential Commission outlines a $3.8 trillion theft from the workers, seniors, and the disabled, and the sick.
And now, a Presidential Commission's leaders outlined a $3.8 trillion deficit-cutting plan that would trim, among other things, Social Security and Medicare, reduce income tax rates, and eliminate tax breaks, including the mortgage interest deduction, the child tax credit, and the earned income tax credit. The outline plan raises the Social Security retirement age to 68 in about 2050 and 69 in 2075.
AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said the panel chairman just told working Americans to drop dead. In an email statement, Trumka said, "The very people who want to slash Social Security and Medicare spent this week clamoring for more unpaid Bush tax cuts for millionaires." While the commission's Alan Simpson said the plan was designed to give members of the panel something to chew on for further discussions, it's enough to choke the rest of us.
We're joined by Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research.
Thanks for having me on.
Why don't we begin with perhaps the backdrop? And I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Most of us have been fed within popular culture the idea that you can't overspend or you collapse, you inflate, you wind up on skid row in a manner of speaking. And that's what we're told effectively is going on, that we have to deal with the issue of the debt and deficit spending, and that's where it's at, and that's the backdrop. So what is the reality? Is that something that comparing it to our own household budget is not really applicable?
No, it's not applicable, and it's particularly not applicable now. I mean, in normal times, it's not applicable for the simple reason we expect the country to live forever, at least for a very, very long time, and we don't expect to ourselves. But more importantly, in the current time, the government bears responsibility for supporting the economy, and this is why this whole discussion is almost otherworldly. I mean, here it is, we're sitting here with 9.6% unemployment. 25 million people are out of work, working part-time, want full-time jobs, or giving up work, looking for work altogether. And we're ignoring that, and instead we're saying, oh my God, we have this big budget problem. It's sort of like we have the schools on fire and the kids are still inside, and we've got Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles, the co-chairs of the commission, going, well, what colors do we want to paint the classroom? I mean, it's close to crazy. What we really need right now is more spending, and, you know, again, that may sound scary and strange to people and everything, but the story of the downturn is we lost a huge amount of demand from the private sector with the collapse of the housing bubble, and it's kind of straightforward. We had this huge bubble, an $8 trillion housing bubble that was supporting the economy, was supporting huge amounts of construction every year, supporting consumption because people were spending based on the wealth they had, the equity they had in their home. That money's now gone. So we lost about $600 billion in the annual construction demand, roughly the same amount, about $600 billion in consumption demand because people don't have that wealth anymore. So we're down $1.2 trillion in demand. The government is the only sector of the economy that can make that up. So the idea we should be worried about the deficit right now, it's just 180 degrees wrong. We want the deficit. It'd be crazy to try it. If you want to save money now, you want to throw people out of work. People may not understand that who say that, but that's the reality.
And if we try to, in this environment, cut the deficit by cutting spending, by cutting the deficit in the spending, won't we just exacerbate the whole downturn in the economy and there's no way to close the deficit anyway?
Exactly. I mean, this is, you know, this is money in people's pockets, and this is, you get sort of this bizarre thing, because you have the conservatives say, well, you don't want to raise taxes because that will pull money out of people's pocket, and that is true. It will pull money out of people's pocket. But, you know, if you have workers who are, you know, working for the government, they want to cut government employment, well, those people are getting paychecks. They spend that money. So that's really great. I mean, A, most of those workers are doing something. I'm sure there's some that aren't, but most workers, in fact, do something for their paycheck. So who's going to make up that work? But B, These are people who were getting money. You're pulling money out of the economy. And, okay, it's not a tax, but the point is you're pulling money out of the economy. Those people won't have money to spend that they otherwise would have. So it's really, you know, to my mind, just incredibly short-sighted, and, you know, it's really a vicious policy to talk about cutting the deficit right now. We need the deficit. It's really unfortunate President Obama never explained that when he pushed out his stimulus, that that this is going to raise the deficit, and for the moment at least, that's good. That's what we need.
Dean Baker, one of the things that I was interested in there is, of course, a major discussion going on the issue of taxes and whether or not to make the Bush tax policies permanent. And Obama, David Axelrod's Obama, really seems to say, well, we're still looking at issues of people who make over $250,000. And for them, the answer would be no. What's that magic number of $250,000, and what should we understand about if there is some likelihood that the Bush tax cuts are permanentized?
Well, the number 250 was what President Obama had said when he ran, so that's where it came from. There's no magic to it. I mean, it could be higher, it could be lower, but, you know, he's simply trying to follow through on a campaign promise that he wouldn't raise taxes for people earning less than that, and that he was going to take back the tax cuts for the wealthiest. If it's made permanent, I mean, let me put this way, I really don't want to see it made permanent in the sense that these people don't need the money. But I should just point out, nothing in the world is permanent. You know, if it were to turn out, we don't literally need the money today. I mean, there's better things to do with the money. So if we have, you know, a certain amount of money that we have available, let's say, you know, this comes to about $50 billion a year, let's say we could either spend that, you know, giving it to state and local governments so they can sustain their services, spend it on employment benefits, spend on building up the infrastructure. A whole long list of things that are better than that. But if the question is just, you know, do the rich people get it or no one gets it, it's not the worst thing, given that we want demand in the economy. It'll generate some demand, not a lot, but, you know, we'll give Bill Gates another $20 million. It probably doesn't affect his spending very much, but, you know, somewhere in there some people will spend more. So it's not the worst thing. What is the problem is when we get, you know, let's say somewhere down the road, and hopefully the economy is closer to full employment and we actually do need the money, well, where are you going to get it? And it certainly makes more sense to get it from the wealthy, the people who have been the big winners in the economy over the last three decades, rather than get it from middle-class people or wherever else you might get it. So we will need the money, but I'd say even in a worst case, from my view at least, a worst case scenario, that they end up making them permanent, what that just means is that, you know, they're there until someone takes them back. And, of course, President Clinton in 1993 raised taxes on wealthy people. So even if at the end of the day you end up with them ending up making them permanent, I don't think they will do that, but let's say they did, that doesn't mean, you know, if you get another election 2 years from now, 4 years from now, you can't turn around and raise taxes. So, you know, again, I don't want to see that, but I also would say it's not perhaps quite as dire as some people are making it.
And the other big part of this deficit reduction is bringing in Social Security into the whole mix. Does this even belong in the conversation?
Well, that wasn't what President Obama had charged the commission with. So he told them to hit these deficit targets, to put Social Security and Medicare on sustainable paths. But they made a big point of saying, okay, we're going to reform the Social Security program. We're going to make it solvent over the 75-year horizon, its 75-year planning horizon. That wasn't what they were assigned to do. So, you know, I made a joke about that. I guess they expect extra credit. It's important for people to understand there's cuts in the program that they're proposing that will take effect, well, basically as soon as it gets through Congress, because part of the proposals from Bowles and Simpson that they're going to change the cost of living adjustments, so it'll be about 0.3 percentage point less each year. Now, that might not sound like a lot, you know, so just 0.3 percentage point, perhaps not a big deal, but that's cumulative. So after 10 years, your benefit ends up being 3% less. After 20 years, 6% less. And for people getting benefits 30 years, they're 9% less. And that is a big deal, in particular since the poorest people tend to be the oldest of the elderly, disproportionately women, a lot of them very near the poverty line or even below the poverty line. If you're talking about making their benefits even lower, that's a big deal. So I think it's a really pernicious cut. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but it's a really pernicious cut that will affect a lot of people who need that money.
Well, I'm still reeling from Alan Simpson's email to the executive director of the National Older Women's League, in which he described Social Security as being like a milk cow with 310 million tits. I mean, this is Alan Simpson. So moving from that, but it's hard to in many ways, because it represents a particular mindset and ethic. Paul Krugman described the commission as really a hijacked commission. What is your feeling and response to some of the outline proposals that were indeed put forward by Bowles and Simpson?
Well, they're proposing big cuts. I mean, in addition to Social Security, they're proposing a lot of cuts to Medicare. They're unspecified. They just say we're going to have these savings. It would basically eviscerate Medicare as a health care program for seniors. I mean, they have these targets that call for cutting what we're spending on Medicare close to 50% per person once you get out 15 or 20 years. So, I mean, you sort of assume this isn't going anywhere, but if it did, I mean, seniors will not be able to count on health care coverage, you know, unless they're wealthy and able to afford on their own, which, of course, is not the vast majority of seniors. One of their proposals, they're now saying they didn't mean it. Who knows what these people mean? I mean, they're playing games or God knows what. But they propose getting rid of the earned income tax credit, which is, you know, an important support source of support for a lot of lower income workers with families. That's been there, you know, supported by Republican and Democratic administrations alike. So there's a lot of things in there that are really pernicious, and they're kind of backing away, saying they didn't really mean it. So I don't know if this is all just, you know, a little game they're playing, but this is, you know, try to give them credit for being serious people. If they put a proposal on the table, well, then you say, what does that mean? And this is pretty pernicious.
And one of the things that's not in their proposal, which I know you've been advocating for, is a financial speculation tax. So why don't you tell us why that is and why that would be a good thing to have?
Yeah, well, the basic point here is we have a massive amount of financial speculation right now. People just flipping, you know, stocks, bonds, credit default swaps, other options, futures, other derivative instruments, and it has no economic purpose. They're just making a bet, you know, which, you know, on the one hand, is fine. You go to Las Vegas, you make a bet, you know, whatever. I'm not moralistic about that, but we tax it in Las Vegas. So what I've proposed is that you have a modest tax on these transactions, say for a stock trade, something like a quarter of 1% on the trade. Matter very, very little for people who are, you know, accumulating money for their retirement, a 401k or, you know, a pension, whatever it might be. It would make very, very little difference because these people aren't trading all the time. For the people that are trading by the day or the hour or the minute in some cases, it would be a very big tax. And my calculations are you could raise somewhere in the order of $150 billion a year, $1.5 trillion over the course of a decade with a tax like that. And what's striking here is that it's mentioned nowhere in their report. Now, I know at least one member of the commission, Andy Stern, is a big proponent of this. It would very much surprise me if he never raised it. So it's kind of striking that you had at least one person who was a very big proponent talking about it, and here they make their report where Senator Simpson boasted, well, we harpooned every whale. Wall Street's a really big whale and somehow escaped the harpoon. And in this context, it's worth noting that Mr. Bowles is a director of Morgan Stanley, one of the bailed out banks. He gets $335,000 a year to serve as a director of that bank, and that bank basically walks away from this held harmless. Even though, as I say, many people, Andy Stern being one, I should point out, even the International Monetary Fund is now advocating taxes on the financial sector. So it's kind of striking that everyone else gets hit, people on Social Security, people on Medicare, low-income wage earners. I mean, you go down the list, Senator Simpson's right. They hit a lot of middle-income, poor people, but Wall Street is just fine here. They're untouched.
And the other thing was the role of the Fed in this as it relates to buying up government debt. I mean, there's another question with regard to how that would affect the economy going forward. But how does the quantitative easing that the Fed is doing relate to government debt and the possibility, how significant that is in the long run?
Well, one of the stories that they're telling us is that, oh, we're going to have this huge debt burden because come 2020 we've accumulated all this debt because of the downturn, and there'll be this interest burden that's going to be really crushing and this and that. Well, the reality is that the Fed can, in fact, is buying up much of this debt. And when the Fed holds debt, what that means, this might sound a little silly to people, but this is literally what happens. When the Fed owns government bonds, the Treasury pays the interest to the Fed each year. But then at the end of the year, the Fed refunds the interest to the Treasury. So that's really no burden. You know, what that means is the money goes out the door, comes right back through the other door. That's no tax burden. That's no interest burden. And there's no reason at all not to do that in the current context. So let me just be clear. I'm not saying that we could always have the Fed just buy up all the bonds, the government issues, and everything's fine. It can do that in a situation like we're in now, where the big problem is that we have huge idle capacity, huge amount of unemployment, and the inflation rate's too low. So people go, oh, well, that will create inflation. If that creates inflation, boy, bingo, we're great. We're out of this. You know, if we got some inflation going, we'd start to see more demand in the economy, and we'd be getting it back on its feet. So if that were actually true, you know, we got inflation, well, that's great. We'll get back to normal rates of unemployment. We won't have to run big deficits. Everything will be fine.
It would certainly seem that the Deficit Commission, one might say that it is hijacked. I don't know. It seemed to me it was programmed to failure, but hijacked in the sense that there's just an ideological agenda that's taking place, and the same old tax cuts for the rich and erosion of the social safety net, such as it is these days. What do you think politically comes out of this? Because certainly there was some pushback and some agitation by both Republicans and Democrats to the outline proposals of Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson.
Well, let me just make a point. It was quite literally hijacked in the sense that this is not a commission report. This is a report from the two co-directors. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, here it is, Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles got out there and said, oh, here's our report. Well, that's fine, but that wasn't the way it was supposed to be. So it was, in that sense, quite literally hijacked. But, you know, where this goes, it really is going to depend on public response. So, you know, what they're doing is testing the waters. They threw out a lot. They're seeing what gets people really angry, what doesn't. And if they think, you know, obviously they're quite deliberately floating these big cuts to Social Security. If they think they can get away with doing that, they're going to push forward. So what this is about is taking the temperature of the public, seeing what the reaction is. And if they think that there's not going to be much reaction, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people in Congress, perhaps in the White House as well, who want to move forward with cuts to Social Security, cuts to Medicare, a lot of the other recommendations that are in this report. I should point out, I will be a little, try to be fair to them, not everything in there was bad. So, for example, they proposed capping the mortgage. Well, they proposed one of their versions eliminating the mortgage interest deduction. I wouldn't do that. But certainly I think capping that so that, you know, people that have a $1 million home, the taxpayers aren't subsidizing their interest. I don't have a problem with that. But for the most part, I think most of these proposals are hurting people unnecessarily over a problem that doesn't exist. As I say, there's not a near-term deficit problem. In the long term, when people talk about these horrible, horrible deficit problems, it's entirely a result of our health care cost. We spend today about twice, more than twice the average of other wealthy countries, Germany, Canada, France, whoever you throw in the mix, and that's projected to rise to 3 or 4 times as much. And if that's true, if we hugely outspend, this is per person, everyone else on health care, and much of our health care cost is picked up by the government through Medicare and Medicaid and other programs, then that will devastate the economy. But the problem is health care. And if these guys are being honest, they'd say, look, we got to fix our health care system. If we do, we don't have a long-term budget problem.
Well, we've only got about a minute left, but I just want to point out that we are having this conversation now on the deficit, and nobody's really talking about how to get out of what is still a recession and massive unemployment.
Yeah, and that really should be topic number one. So it's a little bizarre here. I was making the analogy to a fire, school fire, and I do think it's appropriate. I mean, this is, in Washington, you have this idea, oh, things are okay. You know, we had this bad period in September, October of 2009 or 2008 when, you know, the banks were worried that they'd go out of business and this and that. But things are okay now. The banks are all right. Well, the banks are fine, but that's not most of the country. I mean, we know the data is very clear, and most people know people who are, you know, struggling, lost a job, worried about losing their job, had their hours cut, underwater in their mortgage. The idea that things are okay now is close to crazy. But in Washington, you have people running around saying that because, well, simple reason, they have jobs.
Well, Dean Baker, I'd like to thank you, as always, for joining us. And where can people also get some more information from you? I know you're very prolific and have lots of articles. What would the website be?
The www.cepr.net. That's cepr.net.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
We gave millions to make you president. Here's a chance to pay us. The inheritance tax makes my fortune feel all funny.
Hey, George,
gotta let it laugh so my kids can have more money.
Hey, George,
when we get more cash, we get a feeling of elation.
Hey, George,
you can tell the press it's for budget stimulation.
Well, we've got a bunch of taxes that should be definitely repealed, but we've also got to make sure that the Bush tax cuts are not kept, as they are for certainly people who are very rich and make over $250,000. And that was an older piece, but I couldn't resist it with one of my favorite groups who I wish was around much more these days, and that was Billionaires for Bush. We could use a couple of updates on those songs to depict what's happening in our economy at this moment. But we are moving along.
UnemployedWorkers.org is a space of information and a community of people who will be supportive and guidance on how to survive and maybe even thrive in the midst of the changes that are happening.
I got my first job when I was 13 years old, and I've been working ever since.
For the last 30 years or so, I have been a business systems analyst.
My trade is a glazer at Glass Apple Store in Broadway. That's one of the jobs I did. You know, it's unique work.
Worked at the Restaurant Workers Union for a number of years and became an officer, the first woman ever elected.
I'm a public health professional.
Medical clerk, which was way different from retail.
I served about 8 years.
I've worked for all the broadcast networks and Nickelodeon and Bravo and AMC and USA and Sci-Fi Channel. And
it makes you want to give up a lot of time just to say, hey, I might as well just live on the streets and just, but can it go that way?
Feels like a funny thing to say, but you know, I'm just another one of those 20 or 30 million people.
Once you don't have a job in America, that is, it's devastating. How do I survive?
This is a national emergency. It's a national crisis.
You shouldn't have to lose your life and everything because you lost your job. It shouldn't have to be that way.
I've always wondered, even when I was comfortable, how does a person go from being okay to just living on the street?
We didn't have a natural disaster, but we had a financial meltdown, we had a home mortgage industry crisis, and we have huge unemployment with no job creation. People have bought the line that there's sort of this invisible hand in the economy that works, and the truth is that's not true. Everything in the economy is driven by one set of rules or another set of rules, and the questions are who gets to make the rules and what are the rules. It's not the case that we don't have a choice whether we're going to extend unemployment benefits and how long we will extend them, or that we don't have a choice about whether we might create some kind of public sector jobs program. It's important for us to be aware that we have that power, and then to make choices that are consistent with what the kind of nation we are. I'm hopeful on a good day that we will have the resolve and the vision and the commitment to tackle what are real problems, and we'll build a new kind of economy that provides work for everyone who wants to work and that will value workers, that are, we won't just create jobs, but we'll create good jobs that support families. I think we can do it. We've done it before.
UnemployedWorkers.org is a phenomenal site which has also helped me to overcome the stigma and the loneliness of being an unemployed person. So please come in and join us at UnemployedWorkers.org.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.